I got another question here.
Huh?
I really like that answer, by the way.
Thank
It
you.
very moving, for sure. What do you think about this is, and there are kind of some crossovers here, but what do you think of finding a balance between destroying the systems of oppressive power and building the world we want to see? I guess we talked about this a bit in strategies and tactics, and we'd cover this a little bit, but I wonder if you have anything more to say about that.
Well, you know me that I do. And there's a couple things about that. One is I do get dinged a fair amount for not presenting, positive alternatives. And one reason I don't is because the Indians already did, and the indigenous peoples the world over already have. And we don't need to. I mean, sure, we can. I mean, every cell in my body wants for us to have some sort of soft landing. And so, the people that are doing work on renewables and sustainable communities and all that, I think it's really important work, with a couple caveats. One is, once again, the Indians already did that, but that doesn't, we can still try to bring, we can still try to help figure out how the landing could be softer. Great, that's really important. But at the same time, okay, years ago I did this, I was at this sort of conference deal, and there were like 20 of these longtime activists, 25 or 30 or something. And one of the questions they asked is, they said, okay, pretend it's 20 years from now and we've all, we've somehow had this miraculous transformation. We're living sustainably. What would that look like, smell like, blah, blah, blah. And everybody's giving all their answers. And it made me just furious. And I said, this is really painful for me. And one reason is because, A, you haven't talked about the transition, which is going to be painful. And two, or B, or whatever, if we develop this sustainable community within the larger destructive context, and those in power discover resources on our land that they want, we all know what happens to our community, to the resources, and to us as individuals if we resist. And so it's like being, once again, in an abusive relationship and trying to figure out how you can make a little sanctuary within that abusive relationship. Because the dominant culture is insatiable, and it's driven by a death urge. And we, if no matter what good things we develop, it will continue. It doesn't matter if you have this wonderful eco-village on a planet that's entirely toxified. We need to stop that at its root, which is not to say everyone needs to be doing that work, because there, I mean, this is just my proclivity. And if someone has a gift for working in that direction, I mean, it's like if somebody's gift is to build straw bale houses, it's like, we need it. We so need it. And if somebody's gift is to, work on peaceful conflict resolution, go for it. I mean, I'm so inclusive on tactics as long as the other people are inclusive of tactics that they don't particularly choose. And so I think it's all so necessary. It's all absolutely necessary. But and what's forgotten in that quite often is that we need to stop the system that is destroying the world. And that will necessarily involve destructive work.
Thank you, Derek. We have another. It's less of a question, more of a statement from someone who called in, and they've been thinking a lot about the emotional sustainability of political struggle and resistance. And as a person of relative privilege, they're feeling exhausted and losing hope as we endlessly seem to be cleaning up the messes of capitalism. And they were wondering if you could speak on that, the hopelessness that we feel, or
That's
they.
great. I think hopelessness is wonderful. Because, as I was saying, with the whole, I think hope is a really problematical thing, because it's it's an acknowledgement that you have no agency, and what I'm really interested in is agency. And if, and I don't have a problem, by the way, with being a person of privilege and using that privilege, because it is my responsibility. I can say things. I mean, I've had after I wrote Culture Make Believe, which is partly about race issues too. This African American guy came up to me and said, you're saying a lot of things that people will listen to because you're white, and I can't say them because I'm black. If I say them, I'm just this angry black man." And I said, "Great. I have been given, because of my skin color and because of my, my chromosomes, because I have testicles, I've been given certain privileges because because I've been privileged enough to know how to read, and it is my responsibility to use those privileges to undercut their very basis. So that's a really important thing. And so far as the hopelessness, I think when I recognized that, when I recognized that, you know, we aren't going to make it to some great new glorious tomorrow, and that the dominant culture, unless it stops, is going to kill everything on the planet, that was both a tremendously sorrowful point, and it was also very quickly I want to tell that story because I started to tell before we got cut off, which was that a few years ago I got a call from a friend of mine who said, she's an activist, who said, you know, this doing this activism is just breaking my heart. It's just killing me. I said, yeah, I'll do that. And then she said, you know, the dominant culture just hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. And then she said, it's driven by a death urge, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. And she said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. And then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I said the best thing I could possibly say, which was, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing I could say is because about 12 years ago now, or 12 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse. I was just bursting into tears all the time, and just sobs and sobs. And a lot of my environmental activist friends of mine were saying, you know, just take some time off, you know, think the problem's still be here when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. And in the midst of that, I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan, Indian, an activist and writer. And I said basically those same questions. You know, it's like, this is just killing me. This work is so hard. Yeah, it is. You know, unless it stops, the dominant culture is going to kill everything on the planet. Yeah, it is. It's driven by death urge. Yeah. And then I said, you know, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said, I've been waiting for you to say that. And that was a wonderful thing for her to say. It was the best thing she could possibly say, because what it did is it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that I could feel all this sorrow and all this pain without it killing me. And even better, that I could feel all this sorrow and this pain and it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. The logic of the Nazis, you know, of if you do this, then, I mean, of co-opting rationality, no longer works. And so once that you dies, the victim you is dead. And who is alive? And the socially molded you is dead. And who still remains is animal you, who is capable of saying yes and capable of saying no, and is capable of loving and hating. And so one of the reasons I'm so big on bashing hope is because I want to get rid of all of those externally imposed hopes, because then when you see a weed coming through the sidewalk, and when you see tree roots, you know, ripping up the asphalt, then you can know, yes, this is real. Because when you see something that's positive, once you're dead that way, once you've given up on the system, then you can start to see. See, that's part of the deal, is these false hopes bind us to unlivable situations and they blind us to real possibilities. And once you've just ruthlessly eradicated those false hopes, when you do see positive things, you can know, you can have a better idea that they come from you and from the planet, not from the culture, not from the oppressive system. And so what I would say to somebody who's fighting that despair is, if you have it's really, really, really important to have a strong support system. If you're all by yourself, then all bets are off on this. But if you have a strong support system around you, I mean, because it's like I say, you know, I don't want to have to revisit Civilization is Bad 101 every time I open my mouth. I don't really have any friends who don't recognize how bad things are and who aren't trying to do something about it. And so if you have that supportive system around you, it's okay to collapse because it won't kill you, and you'll come out on the other side. I mean, the central metaphor of this entire planet is death and rebirth. You know, we all die and are reborn. And one of the things that has to happen for us to effectively resist is that victim has to die, and the socially molded us has to die so that this other being can be born. Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me. Also, I see you saying there that our society is really afraid of sadness. And yeah, I feel that by being sad, that can also be really amazing too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Being sad over things that really make you sad. I mean, how strange is that? And being happy over the things that make you happy.
I have a question for you from Rade, who's been really generously answering the phones and writing down the questions for us today.
Uh-huh.
And he asks, do the notions of economy and economics inherently alienate us from our surroundings?
Do the notions of economy and economics inherently alienate us?
Mm-hmm.
I think that we can say that definitely within a capitalist system. I'm hesitating because, I mean, I've had lots of discussions with John Zerzan, I mean, whose work, of course, I respect tremendously, about the whole question of how deeply numbers alienate us. And, I mean, I recognize that as soon as I say there are 10 cats, I am no longer perceiving those cats as individuals. And so on that level, I think that economics and mathematics is inherently alienating, and that doesn't alter the fact that I think that within, and I could change my mind on this, but it doesn't alter the fact that within, that just like any tool can alienate you from the object you're using that tool around. I mean, if I dig with a shovel, that I'm sort of alienated from the experience of scrabbling my hands through the dirt. And it's a question of what you want. If I want to, you know, if I want to dig in the dirt, if I want to have a hole, then a shovel is going to be more handy than a hand. But if I want to feel the experience of what the dirt feels like on my hands, then obviously the dirt, obviously the shovel will alienate me. And I think the same thing is certainly true for intellectual tools, which would include economics, that, and I want to be really clear, on the large scale, of course, it absolutely does nothing but alienate people. On the large scale economics is evil. I'm just saying you and I have a discussion of, you know, we're going to make an exchange where you give me it's not a theoretical example, you know. I took my mom out to lunch the other day, and partly that's, well, let's say it's not really economics, though, because that's building relationship. Because, I mean, usually if we eat together, she usually provides the food. And so I thought it was actually good for building relationship to actually provide the food once in a while. And my point is that I guess that takes it out of economics, because if I'm thinking of this as a simple exchange, I will take you to lunch today and you will, you know, cook me some food tomorrow, then that's a different thing than if I'm doing it in the spirit of relationship. Does any of that make any sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. One more question for you. We have about 10 or maybe 8 or 9 or 10 minutes.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about something that's been on a lot of people's minds lately. And that is this transition or this shift that we're obviously in right now, and regarding climate collapse and peak oil and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just curious what your perspective is about this transition we're entering, keeping in mind those in power's very tight grip and the police state and the military might and all of that. What kind of things do you foresee for yourself and for this general culture? I guess what's going on with this transition?
Well, I'll tell you the thing that scares me the most. The two things that scare me the most, probably second most, is global warming. That really, really scares me a lot. And the second thing, I guess that's the second thing, the first thing that scares me is that those in power will do anything to maintain their power, and they will do anything to not let their perceived control slip. And I have absolutely no doubt that those in power would blow up the world before they would allow their power to be diminished. And so the thing that scares me more than anything is, I mean, it's what Hitler tried to do with Germany. When the war was lost, he was going to destroy Germany. And those are two jokers in the deck that I don't know what to do with. And so those scare me a lot. And apart from that, you know, setting those aside, because that's one of the things we really, really, really need to recognize, is that this is a psychopathological system, and those in power are individually and certainly collectively psychopaths. And by which I mean that they have no conscience, they have no compassion, they have no, and they have this strong need to destroy. I mean, I go through, as you know, in Endgame, I go through and I take the common characteristics listed for psychopaths, and I show one-to-one correspondence with the actions of this culture. And so, I mean, that's part of the transition that scares me. And so, I mean, I don't know what to do about the nukes thing. I mean, a lot of other stuff. I think we can hack away at the system, hack away at oil, and hack away at you know, whatever the supports are for the system. And we need to recognize, by the way, that it's going to be that those in power are ruthless. And if we leave our comfort zone, or I should say, if we force them out of their comfort zone, which means that we leave our comfort zone, they will fight back. There's a great line by John Stockwell, who's a former CIA agent who came out against the agency during a talk he gave. Somebody once asked, "Why aren't you dead? And you know, if everything you say is true, why haven't they killed you?" And his answer was really elegant, which is because they're winning. And as soon as that power slips, which is one of the reasons for the increased repression right now, but the more that the power, the hold of those in power becomes tenuous, the more repressive they will get. And of course, that repression is already happening. Ask the people who are already in prison. But it will become worse. And I mean, I don't mean to get maudlin or anything, but I don't actually think I'm going to survive the transition, because I think this is true. Well, partly because of the Crohn's disease, but also, I mean, basically, as soon as things get really bad, as soon as things start to get really good, anybody who opposes them is dead. And it's like, why were there so many more lynchings after the American Civil War than before? And that's because so long as, there's a great line by Nietzsche, one does not hate when one can despise. And so long as their power, so long as their perceived entitlement isn't threatened, they don't have to kill us. But once that perceived entitlement is threatened, they will not scruple at anything. And I think we just need to recognize that and then move on and do what's right anyway. I keep wondering why the planet hasn't thrown out some disease that's just killed us all. I keep wondering what it's waiting for. And finally, in a book that I just finished not very long ago, just finished writing, I received an answer. And the answer is that, one of the answers is that the planet is still trying to figure out if humans are redeemable. And are you going to clean up your own mess, or am I going to clean it up for you? And we're being given a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to show that humans really are redeemable, and we can, and stopping this on our own. And if we don't do it, the planet will. And it's kind of like the old thing about, I don't know if your parents ever said this to you, but I remember when I was a kid, once my mom said to me, you know, you need to clean up your room, and I didn't do it. And she kept saying it, and finally said, look, you have a choice. Either you clean up your room, or I'm going to clean it up. And if I clean it up, you're not going to like it, because I'm throwing everything away. And that's, I believe that we're at a stage now where the planet is saying that to us. It's like, look, clean it up. If you don't do it, I'm going to, and you're not going to like it.
We have about three or four more minutes, Derek, if you want to maybe finish off.
So we should end on a happy note.
We should. It's up to you, yeah.
Sorry.
No, no problem. If you want to take it anywhere you'd like for the next 3 minutes, that'd be great.
Well, normally I end my talks, there's a really happy section I end my talks with, and this is a happy section.
Okay.
Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pocks and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You're the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You're at the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You are the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You are the mist who settles on the soil. You are the plants who drink the mist, and you are the sun who warms and feeds them. You are the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who float on the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river who is all the rivers and something else. You're the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees and the meadows you flood and feed and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You're the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever, as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who becomes owls, who becomes slugs, who becomes shrews, who becomes soil. You're the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You're the wind who speaks to the trees and the trees who speak to the wind. You're the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You're the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers, waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold, and you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die.
Thank you, Derek. That's a beautiful note to end on, and I can't thank you enough for sharing everything that you're doing and for doing the work you're doing.
Well, thank you very much for the work you're doing.
Yeah, deeply appreciated, and glad to know you're out there.
Well, glad to know you're out there, too.
Thank you, Derek, and to your cat for joining us today for your interview.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And have a beautiful day. I'll be in touch with you again.
Bye.
Okay, bye.